Hey, everybody. How's it going? Good. Glad that you're here. So today we're talking about majesty. When's the last time you used the word majesty? It's not a word that we use very often anymore, or even its adjective form. Like maybe yesterday I saw a flock of seagulls flying into the sunset, pooping on tourists. It was majestic. No, we don't say that. We would say it's cool or awesome or poopalicious or something like that. Majesty is pretty much all but gone from our vocabulary. So it would probably help to define what this word means. The Oxford Dictionary defines majesty as someone in royal rule or reign, or something or someone with impressive stateliness, dignity, or beauty. And that definition actually helps us, doesn't it? Because we actually do relate to a certain type of majesty still these days. And that majesty would be the royals. I'm not talking about Kansas City Royals. But I'm talking about, thanks to the many tabloids that we see at the grocery store, the royals who are Queen Elizabeth, Prince William, Kate Middleton, and their baby. I mean, even though we're Americans, we're fascinated by these guys. Fess up here, how many people watched the royal wedding on TV? I bet there were some of us. Yeah, thanks for being honest. We love those guys. There's this intrigue about their royal power that they have. I mean, their faces are printed on money. We're interested in their castles and palaces and thrones and crowns. And there's just something fascinating about majesty. And the little shift that we have to make today from the tabloid stand is that God is actually majestic too. He is majesty. In fact, Jesus is the greatest example of majesty that ever lived. And as it is with everything that God does and says, His majesty will impact us. And it's meant to bring something out of us and to take us somewhere. In other words, when we see His majesty, it invites us to do something and become something. So there. Those are the main points we're going to yak about today. And in order to really get them in our system, to really digest what this majesty thing is about, we're going to kind of jump into it and not just talk about Prince William. By the way, who had a crush on Prince William in high school? Just me. Oh, I had dreams of living in that castle with him. So we're not going to talk about those guys. We're going to find out what it means for Jesus to be majestic. So let's do that. And before we jump in, I'm going to pray for us. So Jesus, would you show us what this really means beyond our limited view and definition? And would you just expand our picture and idea of who you are and how good and great and majestic you are? And we invite you here. We invite you to do things in our lives, to speak to us, to be close to us. And we just want you to have your way, Jesus. Amen. Okay. So the first point is, majesties can be really dumb. You guys have probably learned some of the stories in history class way back when. King Charles VI of France, that's this looking good looking guy right here, he was known to run through his castle pretending to be a wolf howling at people. He also believed that he was made of glass and screamed when people touched him. King Christian VII of Denmark was known to randomly slap people in the middle of conversation, throw food at the dinner table for no reason, and leapfrog over guests when they bowed to him. That sounds kind of fun. He also refused to love his wife because he said it was unfashionable to do so. The real winner right there. King Farouk of Egypt was a kleptomaniac. He was nicknamed the Thief of Cairo, and he successfully pickpocketed Winston Churchill's watch. And he actually actually invited the Nazis to invade Egypt because he was sick of the British. What a guy. Now, these guys are extreme, but they illustrate something. Often we give power to people who are completely incompetent to use their power well. In these guys' cases, all they had to do was be born to the right people at the right time, and they were given tremendous power, even titles of royal majesty. But this problem extends beyond royalty, doesn't it? Because we've all seen powerful titles given to people who can't carry the power well. And bosses who are promoted and then turn around and squish their employees with threatened control. Or political leaders who starve their own people while they live in wealth. Or movie stars that we idolize, who behind their acting live these lives that are out of control with failed marriages, money, and drug addiction. And then we see this in ourselves as well. How many people do we walk on and use when we're in charge? How many of us have splurged with the company credit card because we've been given a little power and we feel like we deserve to take some liberty with it? And how many of us have singled out the uncool kid at school or work, maybe excluded them, maybe openly or privately called names, rejected, because we had the power of popularity? And oh my goodness, what about the majesty we have over our own lives? I mean, we've all made dumb decisions, haven't we? Whether it was a bad haircut or a bad girlfriend, even the power we have over ourselves, we tend to mess up. We humans have a knack for stepping into power without good bones to support it. We have a knack for being very unmajestic, incompetent majesties, don't we? But even more importantly, these examples, these guys, us, it teaches us that we generally can't trust people with power. And if we don't understand what kind of leader Jesus is and the kind of way that he used his power, then just like these kings howling through their castles, we can't trust him either. And we need to actually know what kind of person of power Jesus is, because he's asking us to respond to his majesty, to step into his kind of majestic living. So this has to be sorted out. Each of us here actually has an opinion of what kind of leader and person of power Jesus is. If you were asked, you probably would have an opinion, even if you didn't think you did. I actually made the claim earlier that Jesus was the most majestic person who has ever lived, meaning the most fabulous royal ruler, person with the most impressive beauty, stateliness, and dignity. But many of us, if we're honest, don't really see him that way, do we? At least not fully. And he was a kind, loving guy, but he certainly wasn't a stately dignitary. He was a peacemaker, but not a brilliant ruler. We might just think he started this hobby of Christianity with some nice quotes and an expectation to give to charity once in a while. We like him, but majestic? Majestic like the great czars of Russia, or majestic like Napoleon or George Washington? Usually not. In fact, we may even picture Jesus' typical day was pathetically wandering through deserty hills, speaking cryptic, disconnected thoughts that made no sense to anybody. I mean, imagine some of the people watching him were like, did you understand what he said? No, did you? Oh, well, let's stick around. There might be an all-you-can-eat fish fry after this. And he could be confusing to people. And our opinions of Jesus are precisely why we tend to trust our therapist or a TED Talk or a scientific journal more than we trust him. Good guy? Yes. Competent to rule the world and everything inside of me? I don't know. He might not be as crazy as these kings slapping people and stealing watches, but we wouldn't most likely rank him above the likes of Einstein or Martin Luther King or Abraham Lincoln as a leader with remarkable, brilliant, competence and leadership and intellect. And if we thought of him that way, we would treat him that way. So I want to help you see. Because remember, we don't trust things we don't believe. So let me tell you about the majesty of Jesus. First, he is smart, as in the smartest. And the guy who creates the universe kind of has to be smart. And the Bible describes his intellect at work in the world like this. Colossians says he holds the universe together, and John calls him the master behind the world's creation. This means he intellectually understands each minute, intimate mechanism of our ecosystem and the delicate balance each creature needs to survive biologically in our world. He has a demand over all the atoms, particles, molecules upon which our whole stinking cosmos depends. And as its creator, he understands the world from a philosophical, psychological, physiological, chemical perspective. And at a very basic level, Jesus knew how to change the chemical compound of water into wine. Really good wine, actually. And he took that same scientific knowledge and he could take a few fish and some bread and multiply it to feed thousands of people. Jesus knew how to create matter from the energy he could access in the atmosphere, right where he was. Einstein spent years of his life understanding and trying to explain the basic concepts that Jesus had mastered. The guy knew how to transform tissue of the human body from sickness to health. He could alter and reverse systemic infectious disease that had no cure. And actually, some of you here have experienced healings and miracles. And you weren't just sprinkled with fairy dust. Your body underwent biological change at the cellular level. Jesus knows how to do that. He did that to you. And from an ethical stance, he brought an understanding to life that has influenced world thought more than anybody. Democracy and equal rights find their roots in Jesus. The status of women has been rightfully elevated because of the way that Jesus spoke to and demonstrated his love among women. Nowhere before the writings of Ephesians 5, which are based on Jesus' words and actions, and which it tells husbands to value their wives above themselves, would you have found the concept of sacrificially loving women. Culturally, women were considered property. Jesus changed that. Hospitals, which have drastically lengthened life expectancy, shortened the spread of disease, and relieved suffering, started with the first followers of Jesus. And they learned to care for the sick from him. They learned the art of compassionately valuing human life from him. He was an incredible communicator, able to relate and converse with people of all kinds of backgrounds, education, and beliefs. And imagine capturing the attention of everyone at the Twins Bar on 4th Street and everyone at the Gitchigami Club. Jesus was comfortable at both booze-guzzling parties and circles of scholarly religious debate. He was wise beyond his years, and he wasn't afraid or insecure. His position of power was intentional. And unlike these guys who were pushed out of uteruses at the right time by sheer luck, Jesus was predicted over thousands of years of prophecy, hundreds of Old Testament markers and references. And his life wasn't haphazard. It wasn't mere nepotism. And it wasn't ill-fitted. He showed up to fulfill a profound calling of power. And the guy had no rough patch, riddled with scandal, affair, manipulation, corruption, hypocrisy, compromise. He didn't manipulate. He didn't turn out to be a pervert. He wasn't found to secretly hate a certain group of people. And he wasn't quietly abusing the communion wine either. He taught the highest and most difficult standard for human behavior: to love, forgive, and care for people who hate you. And then he demonstrated it, even while being killed and tortured, dying for people who hated him. This, my friends, is precisely why the philosopher Dallas Willard says, the reigning of God over life is the good news of the Bible. Because who in the world wouldn't be relieved to see a leader of such integrity, compassion, wisdom, sincerity, goodness be in charge of the world? If he were in charge, things would get better. Because his royal majesty Jesus has good bones. Can you see how good he is? And this should jostle some things in us. It should shake up our opinions of him. Can you see how competent he is to have the title of the most majestic person who ever lived? But this actually has to be sorted out a little further. Because it seems that when we picture God reigning over the world, we tend to picture two different wonky ways. We either picture him as this distant, cold, supervising, grumpy Wizard of Oz who's way off into the stars, barely pays attention to us, and has just sort of got his arms crossed watching us do life. Or we picture him in our heart, like an unseen Jiminy Cricket who faintly whispers the way for us to go. And then we might supplement either of those with a nice cross-stitched Bible verse on our wall or a rattling off of Come Lord Jesus, be our guest before we eat our meatloaf. And we call that God reigning in our lives. I hope you see how silly that seems. Look at the Jesus, the magnificent Jesus that I just described, and hold him up with this Wizard of Oz character or the Jiminy Cricket that we imagine. They don't match up. And it turns out that as we look all throughout history in the way that God shows his majesty, who he is doesn't match up to either of those characters either. Not in the Old Testament, New Testament, or today. This is how folks in the Old Testament experienced God's majesty. Abraham, for example, he's walking up a mountain with his son Isaac about to sacrifice his own son. And as he's walking up there, an angel speaks to Abraham out of the atmosphere and says, don't touch the boy. Stop. Don't do it. This isn't what God wants. God powerfully intervenes and saves his boy's life. Abraham's outcast concubine, Hagar, is in agony watching her son die of thirst in the desert. And Genesis 21 says, God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called Hagar out of heaven, right where she was, and said to her, Hagar, what's wrong? Don't be afraid. For God has heard the voice of the boy there. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. God powerfully provides, saves her kid's life. And of course, as thousands of Israelites are being set free from slavery in Egypt, running out of the country and seeing things like the Red Sea open up before them so they can run through it and escape, they certainly knew that, holy cow, God is right here doing something. He is acting in our lives, powerfully rescuing us. Each time God acted in the Old Testament, over and over, it reinforced that he was right there, that he was doing things in their lives, that he was interested in actually interacting with them. And then Jesus shows up as God and demonstrates his rule like this. Walking up to blind people and talking to them, asking questions and then healing them. Eating meals with people where he allowed the so-called scum of the earth to show up and get close to him. And then saying in front of people who were insanely offended that the scum of the earth was forgiven and clearly loved by him. He touched people. He held hands. He spoke wisdom into people. He personally freed them, cured them. Jesus was at work right there in the New Testament, looking a lot like God did in the Old Testament. There was a striking availability for God to meet present human needs through the action of Jesus. As it says in John 1:4, life was in him, life that made sense of human existence. And then there's today. A few weeks ago, Steve Nicholson was here. If you remember, and he talked about praying for the small stuff, asking God for little things and seeing if we wouldn't see him act in our lives. You wouldn't believe the stories that have come out of that, people deciding to ask God for things. I had one friend tell me that on one particular day, she asked God that he would provide her with a free lunch because she was just trying to save some money. A guy came into the place where she worked, paid for his stuff, and then gave her an extra $5 just because. Free lunch! That's awesome! And many of you have been praying for sweet little Ava Hershoff, who for 2 years has been battling a brain tumor. And her latest brain scan in April showed that the brain tumor that used to be about the size of a golf ball has inexplicably shrunk to almost nothing. And I love that even on the little brain scan, the doctor drew two little question marks next to the spot where the tumor used to be. Isn't that wild? Yeah, I know. You can clap for that. It's good stuff. And really, all these things beg the question, are we paying attention? This means that over and over, God is making it clear that number one, he is presently active. His rule and reign is doing real, meaningful stuff in our lives right now. And number two, his majesty is right here. It's not off in the cosmos. It's not buried in my heart. It's not confined to a quote on my refrigerator. But like Jesus said, his kingdom is at hand. It's right here. It's actually in this room. He's doing things in this room right now. Can we see it? Are we aware? Let him shift our thinking. But if you're like me, and you struggle with coming to grips with him actually doing stuff right here, right now, like in the air around us, there's actually a really great simple exercise we can try out that helps us interact and see his goodness. And it's simply this. It sounds silly, but it does something to us. Bless the first good thing that you see in the morning, and then thank God for it. It might be coffee. It might be a good song on the radio. It might be the way the sun shines through the window. It might be the sounds of birds. It might be a piece of toast. See it and thank God that it's there, that we can taste it, that we can see it, smell it, hear it, and then realize that God's kingdom is actually at work in the molecules, in the atoms, in the particles that are making that toast and that sunshine. And that it seems very insignificant to pay attention to your toast. But what it does is it's a small way of opening us up to his kingdom that's right there. His goodness is all around us. It's like training us to see that he is at work even in the sunshine coming through our window. But it's not just about seeing. There's actually an offer included in all of this. And this is kind of the core of this whole deal. And actually, this offer is highly unusual for majesties to give out. Because typically, a king or a queen restricts access to their kingdom. They don't want hordes of who knows what kind of people coming in, eating up their resources. Usually a king or queen wants more control than that. I mean, who's been to Canada lately? Nobody. We need to get out a little more. Our friendly friends to the north could use a visit. Well, if you guys know, if you go visit there, you know it's not just like a cruise over the border. You need a passport. You need the name of your mom's first pet. You need a maple leaf tattooed somewhere on your body. They're kind of strict. They have some boundaries about letting us in. And that's typical. It's typical for most countries and kingdoms. But surprisingly, as God goes about with his power, intervening and acting in people's lives, he offers a wild invitation to everyone. And I seriously mean everyone. I mean the down and out, the well-off, the painfully ordinary, the chubby, the underweight, the overworked, the underworked, the folks who talk too much, folks who never speak up. And you get it, it's everyone. And this is the message. Join me. Reconsider how you've been going about life, because your life can now actually be lived with me, where I'm at work. You can take up permanent residence in my kingdom. Or said in a different way, rethink your plans for living, because living in the kingdom is now an option. And these are all just paraphrases of Jesus' words in Matthew 4, Matthew 10, Luke 10, Mark 1. And he tossed these words out quite a bit. And this is quite the pivot, actually, because an insanely good king, who's not just for looking at with awe and respect, is literally giving us the option to live with him in his reality. And this is opting in, like you can opt in to immigrate to a better country or opt in to high-speed internet. It's there, it's available, you can connect. And we can choose, actually, to not just hope to stumble into it or hope that it comes meets us or just watch from the outside, but we can move into it and really see it move into us. He actually invites us into a pilgrimage that goes into his life and into his living. So forget how ordinary you are, if that's your hang up. Forget how extraordinary you are, if that's your hang up. We have the opportunity to opt into his kingdom. And here's a thought. Think of the most deplorable person you know. Think of the person who disgusts you the most. Maybe it's yourself. God is offering that invitation as well to them, for them to opt in and be blessed. That invitation is stunning. Yet even as I share that all this goodness that God is and his wide open invitation to come into it, you might find yourself hesitant, and there may be a number of reasons. And there were very much varied reactions to Jesus and his kingdom when he was alive as well. Some still couldn't see his majesty. They couldn't accept a majesty who was saying and doing things that Jesus said and did. Maybe they just didn't want to accept it. They wanted someone else or something else, a majesty with a different message and a different idea of reigning in their kingdom. Some wanted a violent revolutionary. Like some of us root for a leader who's going to stick it to the man, stick it to big money, corporations, the government. Some wanted somebody who would conform to proper conservative outward appearance. Like some of us want a church leader to tell homosexuals they can't be Christians. And on the flip side, others wanted someone who would give them the nod to live however they wanted, in whatever way that looked like, whether it was their sexuality, their money, how they pursued gain, their definitions of beauty and freedom. We don't want people to tell us we're not the boss. And this is the funny thing. Almost every other majesty demands that we submit to their kingdom, to their rule. In Sudan right now, maybe you've heard this news story, there is a woman named Mariam Yaha Ibrahim who has been sentenced to 100 lashings and death because she did not follow the religion of her father, which is illegal in Sudan. She was arrested for apostasy, given 3 days to renounce her faith in Jesus. She refused and she was sentenced. If she will not change her mind and submit to the rule of that country, they will kill her. But Jesus does not force himself upon us. And he has a billionth amount more power than Sudan. And he won't jump down your throat. He will not force you under his rule. He is a majestic gentleman. He allows us the freedom to see him and respond if he'd like, or to continue with our own rule. He sees no real benefit in forcing himself upon us. But this is tricky, because this means that we will continue down whatever path we choose. And in other words, if in our hearts, we really want to be God ourselves of our own lives, if we want to have our own terms of ruling and reigning, then we probably won't find him. We will probably find more of ourselves. And Jesus actually had some serious words about this in Matthew 7. This is one of the, John says, one of the mean Jesus passages. He said, "Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it." That was a mean Jesus passage. But he's sort of just explaining reality. Most of us have this struggle. We don't want to give up the power. We don't want to give up our own rule and reign. And so his invitation, it pulls on us. We see the good of it, but it's also very uncomfortable, isn't it? Because it calls for a kingdom swap. He is asking us to give him our majesty, the rule and reign and ownership we have over our own lives, as much as we can. And it means he'll want to work his majesty into the fine texture of our life, into our social lives, our work lives, our diets, the way we plan things, the way we speak, the way we view people. And he says it in Matthew 11 like this. He poses the invitation in this way. Are you tired? Are you worn out? Are you burned out on religion? Come to me. Get away with me and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. And of course, we don't get it all. You know, saying yes to that doesn't mean we have to understand how Jesus could wield energy from thin air and change water into a nice Pinot Noir. I don't get that. And we don't get everything that he's trying to say to us or teach us quite yet. But seeing his brilliant goodness combined with his tremendous power, we see that he's right. He conducts life in a way that I want to be a part of. And we begin to see and believe that he really is the greatest and the best. And then our opportunity becomes opting in. My kingdom for yours, Jesus. So let's flip the tables a little bit here. Where are we unconfident and untrusting in his kingdom? In other words, where do we still feel totally equipped to rule and reign in our own world? For me this week, it's been my opinion of people. I feel totally equipped to judge and determine who people are, this is embarrassing, and whether they deserve good things. Specifically, whether they deserve good things from me. Now, Jesus sees fit that everyone enjoy good things. Will I bring my kingdom into his and allow him to teach me to live generously like he does? What part of your kingdom is he asking you to give to him? So if you've swapped your kingdom a little bit or a lot of it, you guys know that this doesn't work just like a barcode though, does it? And otherwise we'd all be acting like Jesus 100% of the time, which I know I don't do. And rather, we're learning to be full-time residents in his kingdom, aren't we? We're learning to live there. And here's the big stinking kicker. Instead of swapping our kingdoms and becoming numb robots, where we just sort of like blindly follow him around, we have no personality anymore, we lose any zest inside of us, he actually means to train us to become majesties with him, fellow rulers with God. And this time with the good bones to do it well. And every other kingdom has these freaking hierarchies of the king, the right-hand men to the king, the mayor, the peasants. And you guys know, I mean, we don't live in that culture, but we have our own hierarchy here in Duluth. People who are cool, successful, blah, 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 down to the poor, the down and out. We have a spectrum of this weird hierarchy. But this isn't in God's kingdom. He means to take each and every one of us, no matter our qualifications, our backgrounds, the stuff we got going on inside of us, and to make us into rulers with himself. I mean, this is like Queen Elizabeth holding a workshop in which the description reads, "I will teach you everything you need to successfully become a king or queen and release you to do it, diamond tiara included." And that would be nuts. Queen Elizabeth wouldn't do that. And majesties usually aren't secure enough to show people how to have power with them. They're afraid they'll lose their power. And we, usually when we see someone larger than life, we think to ourselves, "I can't do that. I can't be like them." We disqualify ourselves immediately. But you see, Jesus's majesty doesn't do that. You see, he actually empowers us to become more than we've been. And his greatest goal for us isn't that we would be managed, oppressed goody-goodies. I know some of us are afraid that he would do that to you. But actually to empower us to do what we want. I'll say it again, because that was confusing for me when I first thought about that. His goal for us is to empower us to do what we want. And I don't mean it in the sense of, you can't tell me what to do, you're not the boss of me. I mean, his goal is to take our ordinary kingdoms that he gave us in the first place, actually, imagine that, and form us to this intense bond with him, this trust with him, where he's turning over our lives with his spirit and growing this internal character of Jesus so that in any situation we would be a part of, we would begin acting and speaking and exerting our majesties like Jesus would. We begin living our lives as if Jesus were living our lives. And I don't mean that we would all put sandals and a robe on and, you know, walk around doing the unique ministry and calling that Jesus had. I don't think many of us are called to that. I think probably only Jesus was. I'm saying that we steadily grow in our ability to draw direction, strength, and our life's vision from his kingdom, which means that for bankers, engineers, taxi drivers, teachers, daughters, husbands, business owners, can you imagine if the same goodness, compassion, wisdom, sincerity of Jesus were coming out of you as you met with a client, or delivered a pizza, or taught a class, or drew up your blueprints? Whatever your day entails, that Jesus' life would be expressed out of you as you live your specific life. Because no matter what, God has designed you to rule. We already know that, actually. And we rule all the time in our lives. We're making decisions all the time. And a lot of times, good comes out of it. But what we can do with our own means is very small compared to what we can do with our majesty and power in joint union with Jesus's majesty, who created the power to begin with. Our majesty can either grow and grow under his kingdom, or we can rule to our limit. His desire is that we would become people who would do what we want and be trusted to act out good in every situation, where there would be nothing evil we would have to do to succeed, where it would be safe to do and be good. We are released to rule with him and like him as we submit our lives to him. Our very good, majestic God is inviting us into a shared life of majesty with him. It's good stuff.